You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Robin Green returns to the show this week. She is the author of one of the best books of 2018, the highly entertaining memoir, The Last Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. That book deals primarily with her time at Rolling Stone magazine and the events in her life that led her to San Francisco in the 1960s and her encounters with rock stars and politicians and movie stars. But after she left Rolling Stone, she eventually made her way to Hollywood, where she became a very successful television writer and producer. She won Emmy Awards and Golden Globes and a Peabody Award for her work. She and her husband, Mitch Burgess, are the creators of the long-running drama Blue Bloods, and Robin Green was, 20 years ago, a writer and producer for the groundbreaking series The Sopranos. Since this is the 20th anniversary of The Sopranos, it seemed like a great excuse for another conversation with Robin Green. Robin Green, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So before The Sopranos, you'd already won an Emmy for Northern Exposure, which was also kind of a pretty quirky show. Did you have an ambition to write for television?
Never. I didn't own a television, and I lived in Los Angeles, and I can't explain why I didn't have a television, but I think my parents came to visit me, and they said, it's awfully quiet in here. Don't you want a television? And so I finally got one, but I really didn't. I didn't connect the idea that I could write for television. It just didn't occur to me that someone wrote those lines. Just as really I hadn't thought about being a journalist. It was just an opportunity that I had. So one of the people that I went to Iowa with, John Falsey, who actually just died. There was a huge obituary in the New York Times today.
I saw that, yeah.
About that, yeah. Very sad thing for me. I knew him at the Iowa Writers Workshop. He was in my a seminar that I attended, and we became friends, and he was friends with the man who was my writing partner and became my husband. And we all went to L.A. at the same time, but John started writing for television, and he's the one who, he was reading my restaurant reviews in the L.A. Times, and he called me up and said, he remembered my short stories, and he said, you'd be great for this new show we're doing, which was not Fate Elsewhere or Northern Exposure. It was between those two shows, and it was called A Year in the Life. And they had won an Emmy for the miniseries of A Year in the Life the year before, and now they were doing the TV series. So I went right from nothing to 100, you know what I mean? Richard Kiley was the star of the show, and Eva Marie Saint was in the miniseries, but unfortunately it was about her dying in a traffic accident, so I didn't get to work with her because her character was deceased. But it was Sarah Jessica Parker was on that show at 16 years old or something.
Wow.
And Adam Arkin was on the show, and I got to write something with Alan Arkin, his father. So it was like dying and going to heaven. It was just the most amazing experience to be on that show. And to write episode one of it, actually, that was my first TV show. And then after that, they just keep you working.
Well, you did. You worked on some very interesting television programs, even all before The Sopranos, but of course after The Sopranos as well. But I mean, you worked on some things that were like short lived, but like really promising shows with interesting people in them.
Oh yeah, I was just really really lucky, and the timing was good. The second show I worked on was a show that David Chase had created with Larry Connor, whose daughter, you know, is one of the producers of Girls. But then she was just a baby, but. So I met David Chase that way. He read my material from Year in the Life, which had been canceled after a year, which is another long television story, and another sad television story. Sad for television, great for me, because as it worked out, you know, I met David the next year, and it was a great experience working with him. And, you know, we forged a friendship after that.
That was Almost Grown, is that the show?
Almost Grown is what it was called. And it was very much involved with music, which I loved, of course. And David was exactly my age, so we had the experience of the 60s together. And the show really referenced a lot of our generation and a lot of that. So it was just a place where it was just a perfect show to be on and really, really fun to write. And again, it didn't last, but it was a wonderful experience of writing and working with people that I really liked. And a good show. It was a great show. And the music would send you back to different periods in this couple's, this divorced couple's life, and you'd actually have, you'd go back in time with them because of the music. So we got to see like 16 again and all the rest of it, you know.
Right, the show had flashbacks to them in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah. It was delicious to watch. I mean, it you know, because the music was so great and so respected. I think the title music was a James Brown song, and all of the music, you know, and then all of the music was practical. In other words, it wasn't music cues to tell you how to feel. It was actually music that existed, that had some reason to be there, like the radio went on or something like that. Do you know what I mean? You know, or you were in a car and the radio was playing. You were going somewhere. So it just was a tremendously rigorous show, and David was great to work with. And that was, you know, that came back later when Sopranos rolled around. But meantime, we worked on Northern Exposure. I started writing with Mitch, who I'd met in Iowa. And he came on Northern Exposure with me, and we did that for 5 years. We were there the whole run of the show.
And you won your first Emmy there.
I did. We won, I think, the Emmy for best drama that first year. It was really a surprise. It was really a surprise. It was really a surprise because I didn't know, like, how to get dressed for the Emmys, but I learned. I learned. My education is a TV writer. To learn how to have your hair done properly, you know, that kind of stuff.
And then, you know, you got to walk up there. I mean, that's one of the things, it's one of the fantasies that people have, I'm sure. I mean, I do. You know, when I win my Oscar, when I win my Emmy, my Golden Globe, what will I say? Who will I thank? And you had that actually happen to you. What was that like?
Yes, it is.
Can you remember the moment?
It was wonderful. Well, I just remember looking really weird. That's what I mostly remember when I see the pictures. I said, oh, my God, that dress, and look at your hair. But, you know, you're on a tuxedo, and it's very heady. I mean, there were lots of events that year. We might have been at the Golden Globes. We probably were. I don't remember. But, you know, your first taste of limousines and stuff of fantasies. I guess I thought about, everyone thinks about winning an Oscar. But since I'd never thought about writing for television, I guess I never imagined winning an Emmy or Golden Globe or any of that stuff. But when it happened, I really loved it. It was exciting. It was very exciting, all that stuff, you know. And the actors would come down from Washington, and so you'd get to spend time with them more than, you know, this is Northern Exposure I'm talking about. And so, you know, it would be one big party. Television is, you know, they don't tell you this, but it's a lot of fun. You know,
it's fun to watch. So, Northern Exposure. What, you were a writer? Were you also a producer on that show?
I think I started off because I'd already had a show of my own, very briefly one summer, and so my title went up. And so I think I started as I was co-producer and then supervising producer, and I think that's as high as I went there. I can't remember. Maybe co-executive producer, because it was there for so long. But I don't remember that part of it. I just remember writing the things and, you know, occasionally going up to Seattle to produce the shows. But it was, it was filmed in a different city, so I wasn't off set the way I was at The Sopranos and other shows. We are really expected to be in the set and produce your episodes and make sure that the director has the right tone for the show, and that the right stuff is there, you know, the props and whatnot. And to be there for the actors, I suppose, too. But that was true with David. He liked you there. Northern Exposure took place in a different city. So most of what we did was just be in a writer's room all the time. You know, after year, but it's fun, and the work we did there was great. You know, I love the stuff, and I'm friends with Josh Barnett, who created the show, and you know, he's reprising it. It's coming back, so you know.
Will you be involved?
No, because you know I've learned a lesson, and that Josh and I are friends now. You know, we let him know that if he needed us, we would be there for him. There was anything we could do, but I think it's a mistake to go to work with friends, because they're going to be your boss. It's a seismic shift. And I think that's part of what happened ultimately with me and David when I'm back in it now. And because it's the 20th anniversary, I'm talking about David Chase, you know, I have looked back the last week more than I usually do.
Because there's been so much press coverage and articles and so forth.
Yeah, so much. And I can't resist, you know, they have all the actors on the Today Show. It was just wonderful to see them again. It was the first time that they had all gathered, you know, all of them. And, you know, and many of them, like me, don't watch the shows. You know, you just go on and you remember it. But it brought up the memory, really, of how much fun it was to see that show and what a great time we had. And a lot of that is reflected in the shows, especially that first year, because we were all in the can before we aired. And so, in other words, they were all filmed and cut, everything, and mixed. So we didn't really know what was going to happen with the show. We just did it for fun. Did 12 episodes. The pilot had been shot. And we did 12 episodes just for the joy of what we were doing. It was just the most fun you can imagine. It was. I mean, we were working 16 hours a day. It didn't seem like work. It just seemed like my life, our lives. It was emotion.
So you had no idea when you were working on the first season of Sopranos that it would be... I mean, you had already had the experience of working on lots of shows that had only done 13 episodes.
That's right.
You didn't know there would be 86 or however many episodes.
No, we didn't know. We couldn't imagine it. But we knew at the time that we loved what we were doing. All of us. Actors, everybody.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And we're talking this week with Robin Green. Robin Green is the author of a great memoir called The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. And she is also a very successful television writer and producer. We're talking today about Robin Green's time working on The Sopranos, that groundbreaking HBO television series that premiered 20 years ago. So I guess one of the things about The Sopranos was that you were freed from the constraints of network television, not just by the language that you could use or nudity. I mean, I think the Bada Bing is the first strip club on television to actually have naked women rather than women with clothes on. But you could also, you didn't have to worry about the commercials and structuring the show in a certain amount of acts, like I guess you had to in other things. So what was that like?
Tremendously freeing, you know, and harder because instead of 43 minutes of television, you'd have to provide 50 or 55, do you know? So the scripts were longer, and they didn't have the same construction. I mean, I read both scripts. Mitch and I both did. We read before the show was even shot to pilot. We wrote the versions that David had written for network and without nudity and swearing, and then for cable with nudity and swearing. And by the way, cable was like the elephant graveyard in those days. I mean, there was nothing happening on cable much. So you didn't want your show to be, you wanted to be picked up by network because that's where there was, you know, twice as much money in it at the time because they did more episodes and you're paid by the episode, and also more viewers, more bodies. But as it turned, and so what I started to say was that both of those versions, the network version of Sopranos and the cable version, were fabulous. They were both great. That said, it was a gift from, you know, above that it went to cable finally. Everybody turned it down. All of the networks turned it down. Maybe you've read this elsewhere, but it wasn't so much that Tony was a murderer. It was that Les Moonves said, does he have to go to a shrink and take Prozac? I mean, that's what offended Les Moonves about Tony Soprano. But finally, it was HBO who had a glimmer of interest in the beginning, and David and Brad Gray, who David had a deal with Brad and his company then. Brad said, let's go back to HBO because they had expressed interest. And that's where it landed. And they said all the right things. You know, Chris Hallberg said, let's film in New Jersey. But, you know, he wanted to make it as real and good as possible. He got all the, David got all the right messages from HBO. So that's where it ended up. And it allowed you more of a three-act structure. So, yeah, there were no commercials. You didn't have to manufacture cliffhangers every every five pages. But, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It gives the form to the script. And this didn't have as much of a form, but the lack of commercials allowed you to do more storytelling. There were just more stories. There's more story and more silence and more time for stories. It was just a huge luxury. It was great.
That was
really fun.
Like a lot of people, have been watching some of the older episodes, and I noticed that the scenes don't necessarily have. I mean, some scenes are long with lots of dialogue. Some scenes are long with no dialogue. Some scenes are short. It doesn't necessarily have a climactic scene. It suddenly just kind of fades away. The dialogue is very naturalistic. Not just the fact that people can curse, but the way they talk is not usually the way people talk on television.
Yeah, and lying to each other all the time. Yeah, I guess it's more a fly-on-the-wall kind of approach rather than people saying exactly what they're thinking and feeling to each other. They're lying most of the time or in denial or just being devious.
Well, so in that way, you don't have characters necessarily that people love, although everybody did come to love the characters for some reason, even though they're evil. There's nobody who's particularly wonderful on the show, I mean, in terms of being a good person.
You mean, well, I guess Dr. Malfi.
Yes.
She's a normal person anyway. But yeah, everyone is pretty compromised in one way or another. And this was a show in which you didn't have to make your characters likable. That wasn't the edict. It was quite the opposite. It was just the day of the anti-hero. And I guess, you know, I don't know the antecedents in television for the anti-hero, but this could have set some kind of template for that or precedent for that when you consider Breaking Bad afterwards and all the rest of it that came.
The fact that you didn't have a television, that you didn't watch a lot of television, so you weren't influenced by Gunsmoke and The Fugitive and things like that?
Well, you know, I saw all those things, but I guess when I was a kid or something, I've seen The Fugitive and Gunsmoke, oh yeah, and Bonanza. I mean, I grew up with a television. It's just when I went out into the world, like, I just didn't watch it. I just didn't have one. And then people started talking about, I guess, Hill Street Blues, you know, became kind of a cultural phenomenon. Maybe I watched that. And then I was fired from a job, so I was home all day, and I really started watching television. And then I realized why I didn't have one, because when I did, that's all I did was watch.
It's addictive, right?
I just kept watching it. But then that's when it occurred to me, when I saw, it was like an aha moment. I was watching some show, and somebody said to this other person, "Emergency, emergency, get the truck." And I thought, I could write that. That's something I might be able to do. And there I was in Hollywood, kind of probably there because I had some kind of ambition in that direction, but taking no active step towards it. But it was probably when I left Iowa and went out there with Mitch, that's probably in our heads that, you know, like John Falls, who was working in television, that we would do that too. But really it was only when John invited me to try that I did.
Did dialogue just come naturally to you? How did you learn to write dialogue?
I don't know. Mitch is really good at it. I think you know, John and Josh for a year in the life, I wrote what I thought was television, and they said, this is on the nose. There's no substance. This is terrible. They said, you need to read John Updike's stories, and you need to give us suburban subtext. And you know, because I had been a literature major, I sort of knew what that meant, kind of. And so I rewrote the script and I did a good job. You know what I mean? I just knew, you know what, when I originally wrote short stories, I copied Hemingway. That was the person I related to in terms of his style. I thought I could do it, and I did do it. And then I found my own voice a little bit. So it was more a process like that of putting your heart and mind into the situation of the character and thinking about what they would say. I mean, it's something really simple like that, that you just, you know, force yourself. It's a process of having yourself go there. When you write, you kind of leave yourself sitting there and go someplace in your head. So it was like that. And I'll tell you this, that, you know, I love being a journalist. It was very challenging, but it was very intellectual in a way. Television was heart. You know, you could bring your heart and your humor into it and yourself into it, your whole body, really. And so I loved it. I took to it because I loved the drama of it. I loved the comedy of it. I loved the feeling aspect to it, that didn't come with journalism. And it doesn't come, I don't know, with anything else. I've never written. Mitch is a playwright. He can write a play, but I've never really. I think I tried once. It wasn't very good, and I stopped. I never tried it again. And I don't go to theater as much as he does. He sees everything and has a genuine feel for it. But I think, does that answer your question about what it's like to write dialogue?
Sure.
You know, if I put you in a situation, I don't know what your personal life is, but if there was some situation and I knew that you were having an argument with someone and I knew who you were, especially if I had invented you, then I would know what you would say. And people have different voices, and you have to understand that and write in that person's voice, not your own.
Yeah.
I mean, the process of writing the book was very different from that, because in the book, it was my voice. It was me.
And you invented you.
I invented me, yeah. I had to be very quiet and listen really hard to see if there was anything left after all these years of being other people, but yeah.
Well, your book is called The Only Girl, so was there any resistance to having a woman writing a gangster story?
No. David is the least, no. I mean, no. I never felt anything in the beginning that he was delighted to have me there and have my point of view, but there was no feeling like, oh, you'll know how Carmela feels. Because David invented Carmela and knew exactly how she felt. And Mitch, too. You know, somebody thought with Northern Exposure that he would do all the Maurice, you know, the Army guy, because he'd been in the Army. But really, he was the best writer of the, I think, Shelley. He was a great Shelley. He could get in her voice and just be hysterical as a woman. So there's all kinds of crossing gender lines in the work, you know. And also, I grew up with gangsters, so, you know, my grandfather upstairs was kind of gangster, and I double-dated with the head of the New England Mafia's son, my friend became the head of the New England Mafia. I think he's out of jail now, but he, so I was very, you know, I was conversant with it to the extent that David was, you know, that we grew up around this stuff and had some acquaintance with these people, so... You know, when we used some of my mother's stories from her father in the show that first year, some of the stuff that my grandfather did with my mother that we had Tony do. So I brought that to the show.
Right. I mean, the thing that Les didn't like about The Sopranos was the best part of it, that, yes, they are gangsters, but they're also human beings, and they do the same things that we all do.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, after a while, it kind of got wore on everybody because the show, you know, it lost that kind of first bloom of where that was amusing. And, you know, as years went on, it became much more a gangster show. It had to. It had to, because it couldn't keep the conceit afloat. And so that stuff kind of receded into the background. And frankly, Mitch and I left, we wrote episode 6 of the final season, and that was our last episode. And so we've never seen the final season, but my understanding is that it was, you know, and it was becoming very gangstery while we were there, and that that departed somewhat from the original intent of the show, although I hear great work was done, and the guys really had a good time doing it. Terry and Matt Weiner had come on the show in the 5th year, and it changed the tenure of it. I think that it became this guy thing. And I don't know if it's a guy thing, because Mitch wasn't that into it either. And he's a guy. You know, he watches sports and everything. But you know, and also I will say this, that 5 years is a very long time to be on a show. It's a good amount of time. It's enough.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was hard on James, too. That's what I heard consistently in these 20th anniversary roundups that they were doing, that which I wasn't aware of, that people said that it was starting to wear on Jim to be Tony.
He had enough of it.
It just, yes, I think that the playing that kind of character and, you know, inhabiting that soul, I just think it, you know, it wore him out.
Well, he was a wonderful actor, but what kind of a person was he? Was he anything like that?
Wonderful. I mean, I know he's dead and everything, and you know, but I, you know, I'm very frank, as you know. Mitch hung out with him, you know, so he knows him as a kind of friend. But I had a wonderful relationship with him, and in the beginning, the first year, it was so flirty, but then it was impossible to be flirty because he was so harangued, harassed, you know. I remember approaching him from the rear once and touching him, and he jumped, you see, because people were touching him. Really. And so, and he was a sensitive kind of guy, big but sensitive, and also had a lot of stuff going on, especially in the beginning. He was kind of a tortured person in his process. You'd see him sometimes like punching cement with his fist to feel pain, so that he could bring pain to the scene. I remember seeing that once when we were filming at the house in New Jersey.
Wow.
And it looked awful. It looked terrible. And he stopped that. You know, Mitch said, recalls just like seeing him just become Tony. He'd be Jim, who's sweet and funny. And then, boom, he'd be tied. he turned Tony on. So he got a lot more fluent, and he didn't need to be punching cement anymore, as far as I saw. And that's Jim. And Jim, you know, he's just what you'd think. He's a tremendous dancer, really fun to dance with, graceful, a lot of fun. And I guess Mitch's favorite story about him is he wanted to go to this Halloween party, and Mitch, after work, and Mitch said, well, you go to the party, and that would be fine, but leaving the party, that would be a problem. If I get up at 5 the next morning and go to work, Jim, you know. So he didn't go. They didn't go to the party.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and tonight we're talking with Robin Green. 20 years ago, she worked on a little television show called The Sopranos. And The Sopranos had such a great cast. And not just James Gandolfini, but everybody in the cast was so great, all the way down to the kids. And I always think that's interesting, where you pick a kid to be in a show, and then the kid turns, as they grow older, turns out to be, you know, just a fabulous actor. But how did it affect the writing once you got to know those actors?
It was all about the characters. The actors could do anything. I think that, you know, Janice, the sister, is someone who, because we cast her as the sister and not someone like Annabelle Spiro or some other kind of actress, her person dictated a lot of what we had her do. There were things that she just naturally lent herself to, a kind of personality or humor. So with her, I can definitely see that the actress influenced the story. In the story room, you know, that you wouldn't expect Janice to do the kind of things. You know, I won't say she was clownish, but she was just a humorous character actress. I mean, the best thing that we did with her, and it was the first time I had fired a gun at work, you know, was having her shoot, kill her boyfriend, Richie. You know, I'd never written a show where I had to actually fire a gun in my imagination. And that was really fun. It was really an experience to be a woman with a gun, mad, angry at a man enough to shoot him.
Yeah. And unlike her character, in a way.
Well, she had a temper, you know. But she was proud, and he had dissed her. He punched her in the mouth, and her mouth was bleeding. And he said to her, she was serving him dinner at the table, and she came back into the room, her bottom lip trembling and bleeding. And he said, "So what are you going to cry now?" And she brought the gun out, shot him. And then she played it great after that. She just, you know, got all weepy. She called Tony, and he comes over, and she's all weepy, and she feels bad, you know. And then then Janice goes off on a bus. She goes home to Seattle.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful episode.
I mean, we had to do that because, you know, Nancy Marchand died at some point, either before the second season or during, I can't remember, but we needed to have Tony have another foil, you know.
Right.
And so the sister, I mean, it was a practical experience that had to do with her death and needing Tony to have somebody to play against. You know, that's the sort of way in which the real world events affects, you know, what you need to come up with.
Well, that leads me to the question of how far in advance did you plot the show? How much of it was in your head or in David Chase's head of where it would go, and then something like that happening, like, oh, well, we can't do all those things.
Well, you know, he would come. The very first meeting we had with him was after the pilot, when the show got picked up, this series. He had a couple stories in mind for the first two episodes, just stories, you know. There always need to be at least three stories in an episode, you know, for various characters. But he had a general arc. He would come in every season with a general arc. In other words, this season is going to be about his conflict with his mother. This season is going to be about his conflict with Junior, his uncle. So that you would know the large strokes of where you had to take the various episodes by the end of the season. You knew sort of the direction you were going in. That said, David wanted all of the episodes to stand alone, so they would each have their own concerns and themes. You'd be writing them right against filming. I mean, you'd start, it's a good thing on a show to have like four or five written before you start, and then it's just a race against time. But there is enough time. You know, each one would probably take 6 weeks, and from idea, from shooting the shit in the room to mapping out an episode to the writer goes off, and then it, you know, there's some work to do afterwards. So you're right against filming, but and also we would have on the board, you know, when I just talked about the arc of the season, we would have general, you know, signposts of where we needed to be, say by episode 7 in that particular arc. So this is a structure and a kind of craft to TV writing that carries you along. It's just the story creation is time-consuming, takes time. It takes time to think. You know, Matt Weiner came in from sitcoms. In that room, you're just tossing out ideas and talking every second. So there was like a couple days of that, and we finally said, you know, you got to think. You got to just sit and think. So you'd be sitting there, you know, you need time to just mull in the room. And David was pretty much always there. And we would be mulling, and you know, more than once we would look over, and he had a couch that he had a bad back, so he would lie on this couch, and he'd be sleeping, you know.
Now, maybe he was mulling. It was mulling.
There was thinking, and there was sleeping, and then there was going to the board and mapping out the story. You know, it's really exciting. We did a lot of it when we were teaching in Iowa. We went to the board, the storyboard, with the students, and it just remained the most fun you could possibly have. Is mapping out these stories. That was that was the best part. That was the most exciting part, and watching the episodes take shape. I mean, you'd start with nothing and create something. You know, we did stuff that, you know, that I'm reminded of that we just loved. Like, there was this one called Irregular Around the Margins, which we had nothing. We had, Tony has Mohs surgery, you know, he had a little cancer on his forehead. And somehow that became the birthplace of a whole episode. It was called Irregular Around the Margins, because that's what, in Mohs surgery,
right.
They keep testing the margins to see if the cancer is gone. And someone's wife had been undergoing something like this, so that's what brought that to the story. To the story room. Ridiculous process. But, you know, that was the genesis of that story. And then, you know, like the Malfi rape story was ours. And, you know, that was a story that had always, it's a pretty obvious story, in a way, to do at a certain point in the show. But it was our idea that she wouldn't tell him. Because the idea was conceived originally that she would tell him, and because she wanted the guy dealt with, but it became a story about her moral quandary. So David wasn't crazy about the moral quandary stuff of it, and also that it was Melfi's story. But it was a satisfying episode, and we won a writing Emmy for it, which was hard to get. So I feel pretty good about it.
When you won that Emmy, I remember you particularly thanking the actress for her performance in that episode.
Oh yeah, Lorraine Bracco. She's amazing. I just love her. She's so smart. I mean, you just remember her from Goodfellas saying, I was so scared, you know. But she, you know, she knew French. She was a gourmand, a very, very sophisticated person. Very sweet, nice, good mother. And a wonderful actress. And, you know, really, we all did. She put her whole self into everything. Very present. This is a dynamite woman. And Edie, you know, I mean, imagine giving an actress like that your script and seeing what she did with it. You know, it's just perfect every time. It was just like that, you know, all of them. It was just this wonderful, wonderful thing. I was reminded of this when I saw them all on television for the 20th anniversary talking about the show.
Well, it's interesting because of all the shows that you had done before, except maybe Northern Exposure, but you'd worked on a lot of shows, and all of those shows aired and went away and were never heard from again. But The Sopranos continues to air, continues to be, you know, it's on Blu-ray or whatever.
Yeah.
People are always watching it and talking about it, and it's still, yeah. It's always mentioned when people talk about milestones in television.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they still refer to, like, you know, various politicians, but the role shall remain nameless, as Soprano-like and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yes, it does have a life. And Mitch wondered if it would live, but we run into young people who are watching it for the first time and people, older people who are watching it, you know, again. So it does live. And but I must say the Northern Exposure you never saw again because it was the thing with the rights and the contract. They couldn't air it anywhere again. I think people might watch that, but it wasn't as huge as The Sopranos. It was really huge.
Yeah.
It was.
Well, before we stop, let's talk a little bit about Blue Bloods. So, I think there's a Godfather influence, obviously, on The Sopranos, because The Godfather was sort of the great.
Yeah.
Tournament. But I think The Godfather influences Blue Bloods also. You went on to create this program, Blue Bloods, which is currently in its ninth season, I believe.
Yeah.
And you were there. You created the show, and you were there as executive producer for the first season.
Yes.
There definitely is a Godfather influence on that show, too.
You think?
Sure. You got.
That's really funny.
Because you've got this.
Oh, you mean the patriarch and all that?
Yeah, the family structure, the characters.
Suppose. Oh yes, no. There. Yes, you're absolutely very. That's very perceptive because it's true that we saw the son as a kind of Michael Corleone character a little bit because he was trying to break away and be a lawyer and he goes back into the family business. But I think that's about it. I mean, and actually, the reason that we were pitched. You know, we got pitched a lot of projects after Sopranos over the years and did some things, but we liked the hero, we wanted to do see what it would be like to write an actual hero instead of an anti-hero, and see what that would feel like, and what that would and how that would play itself out, and some of the drama that could issue from that. And again, it was the family scene at dinner, which we wrote and was never changed. It was like an 8 or 9 page scene. And the actors, it was the first thing they, when they met as a troupe, it was the first thing they performed, and that we filmed in Toronto was that dinner, that long dinner. They didn't even know each other, and they were arguing like a family. And it was really exciting because they were arguing about important stuff. You know, if you could have a show, gee, that's a good idea. Maybe we should do that next. But if you could have a show where people would have that kind of debate at dinner, there's just nothing more exciting, you know. We loved that scene. That was real action for us. Never mind all the kidnapping and cop stuff.
Well, I saw the show referred to as a police procedural, and it's definitely not that. It's a drama.
It is a family show, and that's what appealed to us. When it was pitched to us by Leonard Goldberg, whose idea it was, he pitched it for like 30 seconds, and we were standing in our living room and just said, yeah, we can do. We knew exactly what it was because it had all the makings. What you want, it's hard to do family drama. You need this other engine, like a mafia or you know, cops. And so this had an engine that could drive stories, the cop world, and then it also had the family, 3 or 4 generations of it now. And more to come, it looks like. I don't know how long it will go, but it's gone an awful long time. I don't know. Tom Selleck seems pretty committed to it. But it had those ingredients that we knew that this was viable. It was something we knew how to do, and that it was something that could work. That's how it struck us.
And as on The Sopranos, when you cast a young girl, Jamie Lynn Sigler, as Meadow Soprano on The Sopranos, she turned out to be a great actress. And on Blue Bloods, you cast Sammy Gale as Nikki Reagan. She was just a little girl when the show started, and she's turned out to be a really great actress. Now she's 23, I think.
Oh, well, she was a fabulous actress anyway. We had someone else in the pilot we had to recast because we realized we needed a real actress. And we found her. I think she was currently an Annie on Broadway. So she was an actress. She was great to watch. She was a really good little actress, you know. And the boys, the little boys in the thing, we hired them when they were little. They're brothers. They don't look like each other particularly, but they are brothers.
Uh-huh.
And they've become actors, too. They weren't actors. So they, you know,
yeah.
They weren't actors, but they do a pretty good job.
For a while, you never saw them except at dinner, but now they have scenes in the show a little.
Yeah, well, they have, you know, the little mustaches. They're all grown up.
Yeah, and that lives on too. And I think it'll. I mean, it's not only is it still, you know, airing and with new episodes, but all the episodes are there for people to stream and enjoy. And that's.
Yeah, I mean, it has its audience. It has a huge audience for Friday night. It's like more than doubled what they had before. It's something like 11 million people, or was. I don't know what it is now. I check every Saturday, but I forgot to check this Saturday. I just want to see, you know, if people are still watching it.
Do you watch it?
No, sometimes I do. We had a friend who was working on it, and I would try to watch her shows when she directed. But no, I mean, you know, here we are once again. I really don't watch much television. I might start up again, but I don't watch the shows. I watch weird stuff like Shark Tank.
I could write that.
I just, you know, I need a break from fiction a little bit,
uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah, and you're teaching. You're a teacher. You're an educator.
Well, where I'm done with that. I'll tell you that right now. That was really hard. It was really, really hard. I have great respect now for academia, boy. You really, on so many levels, it's challenging. You know, you're influencing young people. You have their lives in your hand in a certain way. It's very important work, and you don't want to screw up, you know. It was a delight, but it was very, very challenging.
Well, let's just mention your book. It's called The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. It's a great book. Everybody should read it. And now I think you should write a sequel all about your years in television. And And the author, my guest, Robin Green. Robin Green, thank you so much for talking with us on From the Bookshelf.
And thank you. Again, it was so much fun to talk to you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.